The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today we feature Dr. Richard Haass, who heads the Independent Council on Foreign Relations. His background includes work in the Departments of State and Defense, and Haass explains the close relationship between foreign policy and economics.
First, for those of you who aren't familiar with the Council on Foreign Relations, it is widely considered to be the country's most influential think tank about foreign policy. My colleagues discovered that the Oxford English Dictionary defines a think tank, I love this, as a body of experts. I always like that metaphor of the body of experts. Providing advice and ideas on specific national or commercial problems. Well, this is an organization that has been doing that for 90 years, the Council on Foreign Relations, headquartered in New York City. And our speaker today, Dr. Richard Haass, has been president of that organization since 2003. He, of course, has a past of service in the Department of State and Defense, assistant to President George H.W. Bush, and he also served as senior director of Near East and South Asia Studies for the National Security Council. Since everyone has to come from somewhere, I'm from South Dakota, he got Brooklyn, which happens to be where that's a compliment, by the way. My wife was born in Brooklyn, so I think it's a great place. He's a graduate of Oberlin and has a doctorate from Oxford University and has served in any number of very well-renowned organizations, including Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He's received awards from the President of the United States and from other organizations, but I won't continue to say that and embarrass him. I will simply say we are so fortunate today to have with us a leading scholar and practitioner of advice on foreign relations and economics. Please welcome to the Indiana Economic Club, I caught him, Dr. Richard N. Haass.
I will do something uncharacteristic today. I'll actually do what I said I would do and what I was asked to. And I'm going to speak about economic challenges and some of their consequences for this country, not just for our economy, but for our position in the world. But let me just say, I won't filibuster. I now live in New York, not Washington. And I'll save a chunk of time for your comments and questions. I'd say for your criticism as well, but as every man in this room, at least the married men will understand now, the whole concept of constructive criticism is vastly overrated. And when we do get to the questions, anything is fair game, not just limited to the few remarks I'm going to make now about the economic challenges facing this country. Let me just say a few things, though, to kick it off. First of all, what goes on in the worlds of economics and politics and national security are closely connected. I realize I'm sitting next to lots of academics here, and academic institutions have departments, Department of Economics, Department of Government, Political Science, what have you. The world doesn't have departments. And essentially everything is affected by everything else, and everything affects everything else, for better and for worse. Secondly, the relationship between economics and national security and foreign policy goes in both directions. Paul Kennedy, a professor at Yale, wrote a book about the relationship between foreign policy and economics, and his whole argument was, if you do too much in the world, what he called imperial overstretch, it can weaken your economic foundations at home. What I thought I'd do today is focus more on the other direction. What's the relationship between things economic and what is going on in the world? I want to start with Europe, because Europe is where things are most acute right now. And I'd simply say there's a crisis going on in Europe, an economic, really financial crisis going on in Europe, but there's also an economic crisis, which is something different. And the financial crisis is the fact that certain governments have reached levels of debt which are unsustainable. Certain financial institutions, the banks, are short of liquidity and so forth. And there's a question about whether the politics of Europe will get ahead of this. And I simply think the evidence so far is not. And that the ability of the 17 members of the Eurozone or the 27 members of the European Union to put together sufficiently bold, sufficiently scaled responses to the crisis that Europe faces is suspect. And the pattern has been one, if you will, where the politics have lagged, and my prediction is that will continue to be the case. At best, I think we can hope that Europe muddles through. At worst, we really will have not just a crisis, but something a lot worse. But on top of that, you've got what you might call the economic condition of Europe. So even if Europe can muddle through the sorts of problems you've seen in Greece, now Italy, and who knows where else, the demographics and the politics of these countries suggest that Europe is not going to resume significant or substantial levels of economic growth, but instead something fairly close to flatline, probably less than 1%, which, or another way of saying it, Europe represents one quarter of the world's output. The percentage that is going to be European is going to go steadily down because the rest of the world is growing and will continue to grow at a much faster pace, and that has all sorts of consequences for our economy and the economies of others. It means that Europe will not be able to absorb an ever-growing amount of goods. But it also means that Europe will be less able, and I believe, yes, willing, to be a central partner of the United States in the world. It's going to be preoccupied or even obsessed, if you will, with events close to home, with dealing with the basics of political and economic life. And the resources are simply not going to be available for large degrees of international activity. And that is a fundamental difference because when you think about the 20th century or, say, the Cold War, the principal geopolitical partners of the United States were Europeans, the NATO alliance and the rest. And I think going forward we have to assume or understand that Europe will not be in a position to be that sort of partner in the of the United States. Again, it's not going to have the outlook, it's not going to have the capacity. And I, just as an aside, I thought it was very interesting. The president spent the last 10 days out in Asia. And what you sense is the United States is beginning to make a transition from a European-centric world to an Asia-Pacific-centric world. That is where the 21st century history is going to be written. And increasingly, the United States is developing relationships and partnerships out in the Asia-Pacific. Those are going to be the countries we're going to have to work with most because essentially all politics is local. And if you're most worried about the Asia-Pacific, you're going to need countries out there. So we're essentially entering a kind of post-European, post-Atlantic era of international relations and American foreign policy, and to no small part, this reflects the economic realities of what is going on in Europe. As I said, though, there are potentially worse consequences than that, and that is if things in Europe really do unravel. And I would simply say that if that were to happen, it would have tremendous repercussions for this country, for this state, for this city. It's one of the realities of living in a global world. What happens anywhere does not stay there. No place is Las Vegas. And what happens, you can figure out your own mottos for the Super Bowl. I will leave that to you. I expect something more wholesome, though, out of Indianapolis. And I think we are the consequences as a result of what happens for us, of what happens in Europe, cannot be exaggerated. And one of the things you realize is living in a global, interconnected world is your fate is not entirely your own. And so what you know, the ability of a German chancellor and a French president and a newly elected prime minister of a Greece or Italy can and will have extraordinary consequences on the economic realities of this country and as I will speak about in a few minutes, on other realities as well. So one set of potential developments and I think shocks that will affect the foreign policy and more fundamentally the situation in the world is Europe. A second is the Middle East. A lot have been said about the Arab Spring. I will simply say it's not a phrase I use for two reasons. One is spring is seasonal, 3 months. whatever else is going to go on in the Middle East. It's not going to be decided in 3 months. It's not going to be decided in 3 years, maybe in 3 decades. We'll have a sense of what is unfolding and what it means. And the other is that spring is positive. And it may be positive in the Middle East, but it ain't there yet, and it's not. There's no guarantee it will be. We'll, again, have to see how things unfold. But, what we know is that what happens there won't stay there. Imagine a situation where suddenly the price of oil went from $100 a barrel to $200 or $300 a barrel. It sounds far-fetched. It's not. It could happen if the sorts of disturbances that we've seen in several countries were to come to Bahrain or to Saudi Arabia. Or in the last few days, there's been a lot of speculation in the Republican presidential debates and elsewhere about what the United States would do if Iran were to get even closer to the development of nuclear weapons than it now is. And would the United States use military force or Israel use military force to interrupt this? What would be the consequences for oil if we were to do this and the price of oil? And if we weren't to use military force, what would be the consequences for stability in the region and potentially for the availability and pricing of oil? And again, either way, you can imagine where one could once again have questions of adequacy of supply, questions of price, and all that would mean for the global economy. Imagine what it would look like here if instead of having oil again at $100 a barrel, we had oil at $200 a barrel. And that, again, is not an inconceivable consequence. And depending, again, upon how things play out in the Middle East, we could see very different consequences for the world and American economy. What else can one say about economic developments and their consequences? Well, third area I would touch on are what you might call international economic arrangements. And by that I mean the sorts of global arrangements you have in the realms of trade, of monetary affairs, and development. And I would simply say, and this is not unique to the realm of economics, but the arrangements that are in place to deal with all forms and shapes of international economic activity are inadequate. Or to put another way, the challenges are greater than the cooperation. We see it in trade, where the current round of global trade talks is essentially on life support. If you want to be generous, you could probably declare the patient dead if you were more brutal. And that means a tremendous loss to global economic output, because trade always contributes to the growth in global economic output. It's a major loss of trade as a development tool. Trade turns out to be far more efficient than any amount of foreign aid we might give, is giving poor countries the ability to export goods to the American market. And yes, you can have various types of regional and bilateral trade deals, but they're second best. So what we're noticing is that we're losing the economic bounce of a dramatic growth in global trade, and we're also losing the foreign policy bounce. And by that I mean, there's a whole theory in my business that as countries develop economic interdependence, countries have to trade with one another, it constitutes a powerful disincentive against conflict. You don't want to disrupt things that are mutually beneficial economically. And if you have a society where, say, economic stability depends upon high levels of employment, and employment in terms is linked to high levels of the ability to export, the last thing you want to do is see conflicts in the region that would disrupt all that. And the inability to grow the global trading order, it seems to me, we lose one of the inhibitions or barriers against regional and global conflicts. So you pay an economic as well as a non-economic price for it. We also find, both in the trade and monetary realms, areas where the world simply doesn't have the pieces in place. There's been a lot of criticism, for example, of China on the trading front, and one of the criticisms that's made against China, and it's exaggerated, but it's still accurate, is that the Chinese currency is artificially kept at a level that allows China to export more than it normally would. In a funny sort of way, China is willing to subsidize its exports. We get them more cheaply, and they are willing to do this not as a favor to us, but as a favor to itself, so they can keep employment levels high, because they're worried about political instability if unemployment grows. Well, there's no way to deal with it other than trying to persuade China to change. There's no international mechanism to get a country like China to upwardly value or revalue its currency. Or countries like China and some others are running large trade surpluses for many reasons. Artificial currency levels is simply one of them, just like Japan did several decades ago. Well, again, the world is powerless to deal with that. We can deal with countries that run chronic deficits because they're dependent on funding, and that gives the world leverage to get them to change some of their policies, and the IMF can step in to deal with that. But when countries run chronic surpluses and accumulate massive amounts of reserve, the world is essentially powerless to deal with it. And this puts the world trading system in an unsustainable position. Other issues as well about problems with what's going to be the currency for the world. And the United States and the dollar provide the world's reserve currency, but there's tensions between things we do, between what we need to do in order to maintain our domestic economic situation, as we will, and our responsibilities to the global system. And how do we square with that? And the answer is we haven't figured out ways. And I could go on, but what I want to simply suggest is that at this stage in history, the economics, if you will, are once again way out ahead of the politics. What else could you say in this area? Let me just single out two things, and then I really want to open things up. One is China. We hear a lot about it. China's now the world's second largest economy. It's the world's most populous country for a while longer until India overtakes it. China's been growing roughly double digits, probably slowed now to about 9% a year. Slowing to 9% may sound pretty good to most of us, but there you have it. The question, though, is what happens with China moving forward? It grows economically, say at 9%, 8%. It accumulates all this wealth. How does it use it? What are then the foreign policy and national security consequences of a richer and stronger China? Does it translate a lot of this wealth to military might? And if it does, how does it use it? A lot of history is about the friction between rising and falling powers, between the great powers of the day and countries that want to take their place at the table. How will China act as it becomes a rising, as it becomes a major power of the day? How will it use its increasingly robust power? And I would simply say that this will very much affect the character of international relations at this time. But also look at China internally. This is a country, and I don't know how many of you have been to China recently, but you can walk the streets of Shanghai and you can find just about everything you're looking for. One of the things that's often hard to find in places like Shanghai nowadays is a communist. What the Chinese have essentially done over the last few decades, really in the Deng Xiaoping era of Chinese history, is the organizing and in some ways motivating force in Chinese society has been a form of consumerism and materialism. And essentially the bargain in China is we will deliver ever-improving standards of living to the average Chinese, and it has been a remarkable success. Hundreds of millions of people in China have been moved out of poverty into some version of middle-class existence. It really is one of the great poverty reduction experiments of modern history, not without its cost to the environment, to political freedom, and the rest, but it still has been a remarkable set of accomplishments. But the question is, what happens, as it will, as economic growth slows? Now it's down to 9%, it will go down to 8%, maybe 7%. What then does a regime do in order to maintain legitimacy? What does a communist party do? If it can't deliver ever-improving standards of living, how does it defend its existence? What does it do for legitimacy? And when protests begin, when Chinese people say, hey, it was one thing to accept a lack of political freedom when you delivered us 10% growth, but why should we accept a lack of political freedom when you only give us 7% growth? How does the regime react? Does it open things up? Does it slam down? Does it become more repressive? Does it turn to foreign policy adventurism and nationalism as a way of channeling popular frustrations? I don't know. But the answers to these questions, to the changing economic circumstances of China, and change they will in many ways determine very much how history plays out in the coming decades. And you can imagine how different the world would be and how different it would be for us if we have China as a sometimes partner to deal with regional and global issues, an Iranian nuclear challenge, or North Korea, climate change, what have you. Or if we have China that's a competitor, and essentially we end up having something like a new Cold War in the 21st century that replicates some facets of the Cold War we had in the 20th century. And rather than having a partner, we have a problem on our hands. It's a very different world. But all of this is not as great as the last thing I want to talk about when it comes to economic challenges and their consequences. And it's the biggest economic challenge facing the United States, and it's not China, and it's not Europe, and it's not the Middle East, and it's not the IMF or the World Trade Organization. It is ourselves. It's like Pogo. We've met the problem, and it is us, or whatever the grammar is there. I want to get my predicate nominatives right in front of all these academics. But the biggest challenge facing the United States in the national security realm right now, I would argue, is what is going on in this country domestically. And that's what I want to talk about for the last few minutes. It may seem odd for the president of a place called the Council on Foreign Relations to end up emphasizing what is going on domestically in this country, but I simply would want to suggest that the foundations of our ability to act in the world are domestic foundations. It's our economy, and it's the quality of our human capital, and I would simply say that those things are now under serious question. I didn't time it this way, but if you woke up this morning, you saw that the super committee in Washington is not so super. It is simply the last demonstration, or most recent rather, not the last, but the most recent demonstration we've seen of the growing dysfunctionality of our politics, and without apportioning or attributing blame, just to say it's bipartisan, let me suggest that. And for those of you who think bipartisanship is the answer to everything, it's not the answer to everything if both parties are marching in the wrong direction. But what we now have is a deficit and a debt that are unsustainable. And the sorts of global pressures which you're seeing played out against the Greeces and the Italies, why could those not be played out against the United States at one point? Why do we think the world is going to be willing to provide the United States unlimited amounts of support if they don't believe we're putting our economic house in order? My hunch is the world won't be. And one day we will wake up and markets will start moving against the United States, and we will be forced to raise our interest rates not to cool an overheated domestic economy. This economy is many things. It ain't overheated. But we are going to be forced to raise our interest rates to attract the necessary debt financing. And what that's going to do is cool an already cooled economy even more. That is obviously the worst of all possible scenarios. But I believe unless we do get our domestic house in order economically, that is the scenario we will wake up to one day. I don't know if it's 2012, 2013, 2014. But it will come, and we will then be forced to make adjustments like the Greeces and Italy's, under far more draconian conditions. So either this is something we will do ourselves, or it will in some ways be done to us. And I despair, not over the lack of economic ideas and possible compromises and formulas, but whether our politics are up to it. And I simply think the jury is out, but there's not a lot of evidence right now, at least, that our politics are up to it. I also worry about our infrastructure. I flew out here from one of the New York City airports, LaGuardia in this case, but anyone who's flown in and out of the airports, and most of the airports in this country, realize they are not competitive, they are not world class. Our power, our electricity grid is wildly inefficient, is decades behind where it needs to be. We don't have high-speed rail in this country. We simply do not have a competitive infrastructure. Our schools. Yes, the best institutions, private institutions of higher learning in this country are world class. That's great. But we also have something like 4,000 institutions of higher learning in this country. Not all are of world class. And particularly those that require state resources, in many cases, are now seeing their budgets squeezed. But far worse than anything at the higher education level is K-12. A K-12 education in this country is nothing short, in most cases, of an American scandal. And the fact that we are not graduating as many Americans as we are, or if we are graduating them, they're not graduating with the requisite skills and tools that they will need in order to succeed in this world they are going to enter. So the real question is whether the United States can rebuild those foundations of its power. If we cannot, it raises real questions about our competitiveness. If we cannot, it raises real questions about whether we can field adequate resources for the United States military, for U.S. intelligence, for U.S. diplomacy to be as active in the world as we would like. And if we cannot, we shouldn't think that at the moment I don't see that others are willing to take up the slack. And for those of you who are economics majors, I don't think there's any invisible hand out there in the world marketplace that will order the world absent American leadership. I really do believe it's either American leadership or no one else's leadership right now. And then there's one more thing. If we can't get our economic house in order, our domestic house in order, we lose the power of appeal. We lose the power of demonstrated example. There are different ideas out there right now in the world about how to organize societies. There's some kind of an authoritarian Asian model, the Chinese, Singapore, what have you model, authoritarian politics to some extent, more state involvement in the economy. And then there's an Islamist version of sorts that's going around the Middle East. Again, lack of secular divides, larger state role, less individual freedom, less tolerant, and so forth. So there are competing ideas out there. And what matters is not what our officials preach. What matters is what the rest of the world sees when they turn on their television sets. And if they see dysfunctionality, if they see economic crises here, if they see a deterioration in social order, that sends a really powerful message that they ought to think twice before they emulate open markets and open political societies. And there should be nothing that we would want more in the world than open markets and open political societies. But the way we make that likelihood much greater is, again, by the power of our example. And I would simply suggest that the power of our example is being tarnished by the reality of our behaviors. And we've got to get this right, or we're going to see the world become, I believe, a less hospitable place for the United States. And all of this will have consequences. We will have less partners to work with to deal with global challenges, whether it's proliferation or terrorism or to promote human rights or whatever your foreign policy causes. We will have less open economies to trade with and invest with and the like. So all of this is connected. So, you know, when I look out at the world, and I don't mean to end on a sour note, because the jury is very much out. The answer is it's still very much in our power to self-correct. But the biggest single question mark and the biggest single factor in determining what is the character of, say, the next generation of history, the next era of history, will be what happens in this country, in cities and states like this one and across the country and probably in Washington, D.C., more than anything, about whether we can restore a situation where this economy grows and where we reduce our vulnerability to the potential intervention of markets that will lose confidence in us because of the scale of our debt, whether we train our people so they are in a position to compete internationally. Let me just give you one statistic, which I actually find very worrisome. It's not that we simply have 9% official unemployment, which probably translates into something like 16% overall unemployment. All of that is plenty bad. But the composition of the unemployment is changing. It used to be that a rather modest percentage of this unemployment, something like 10%, was for 6 months or longer duration. That percentage of 6 month or longer duration of unemployment is now creeping up. It's not quite half, but it's getting close. It's somewhere north of 40%. That has tremendous consequences for social stability, for family stability, and also for the ability of individual men and women to reenter the marketplace. Because after you're out of the marketplace for 6 months, 9 months, a year, why do we think that the skill set you left the marketplace with is going to be relevant? Every day that goes by, every month that goes by, the relevance of the, if you will, the hireability and the competitiveness of that skill set begins to deteriorate. So essentially unemployment is beginning to go from something of a flow to something of a stock in this country. Which has all sorts of consequences and, again, forces us to think about how we then retrain and the rest. So we not only have to get our growth higher, but we've got to find ways to invest in our human capital. So the challenges are enormous. And I would simply say, I keep coming back to, not simply for political stability here at home, not simply for rising standards of living here at home, but that we can generate the necessary resources so the United States can be active in the world and lead in the world, and so that we can demonstrate that the approach we have politically and economically is one that ought to be emulated by the rest of the world. So, and we are at something, I believe, of a turning point. I think the world will probably cut us some slack. They understand we've got a campaign going on. It'll last the next year. But that campaign's going to be over in 11 or 12 months. An administration will then take office, be it the second Obama administration or some other administration roughly a year from now. And I would predict that the world will be watching very closely what happens. And if sometime around 2012 or 2013, possibly sooner, but if sometime, certainly not much later than that, I actually think the world is going to be looking for very clear evidence that the United States is putting its house in order. They don't expect us to flick a switch and get it done overnight, but they expect to see the arrows going in the right direction. And if they see that, I think many positive things will flow from that. And if the world doesn't see it, I think many negative things will flow from that. So this is one of those potential turning points in history. It comes about a generation after the end of the Cold War, 20, 25 years. It's in some ways, it's going to determine the character of the next era, again, of the world. And that's going to depend upon, more than anything else, our political character here at home.
Thank you very much. Those of you, remember, cards on the table. You can tweet directly to the iPad right here. But let me start first with a question that stitches together a couple of the points that you were making. The point about China and its significance is very apparent to us. And the point about the United States and our dependence on others buying our debt. The obvious is the biggest investor is China in the trillions of dollars. What are the, do you observe now, has China done or not done to leverage the fact that they are the significant debt holder of U.S. treasuries?
China's not tried to leverage or pressure the United States, so far at least, on that, in part because there's something of a mutual hostage relationship. It's not simply that China's sitting on enormous dollar pools and doesn't want to see the value of those pools diminish. But again, coming back to something I said before, Chinese political stability, above all, depends upon high levels of employment in China. And so long as China has an export-oriented economy, it needs to export to places that can absorb the imports. The United States represents a quarter of the world's economy, so this is an incredibly important destination. So for Chinese goods. So China has, as do we, a vested interest in maintaining this relationship. So I think that's basically true. That said, I wouldn't take it for granted. I can imagine certain crises where the Chinese may say that's all true, but there are some geopolitical considerations we ought to take into account. But for the most part, I think that the Chinese, again, for their own domestic political reasons, need a strong, healthy United States. Again, I'm less worried about what the Chinese may do than what the markets may do. Markets don't have to be considered. Markets are simply markets. They may act rashly, they may act irrationally, but they act. And the more dangerous thing is not that it's a concerted piece of leverage by the Chinese central bank or anybody else, but simply one day we wake up and markets decide that they've lost a degree of confidence. For all I know, it'll happen tomorrow. I mean, after watching what happened today, or for all I know, it won't happen for 6 months or 6 years. But I just don't believe, who was it, Herb Stein, who was Richard Nixon's economic advisor, once opined that which can't go on forever won't.
Good. Wow. You've generated a huge amount of questions, and I'm sorting fast as I can, but let me
I will be glib here.
That's a challenge. You spoke about economic development being intrinsically linked to national security. Given your statements about the danger in which the U.S. economy sits, do you believe there is any action regarding security that we need to take?
Well, to connect it to economic development, I mean, one thing is you don't want states around the world to fail. When states fail, it's not just a humanitarian crisis. In places like, say, Yemen or Somalia, that's where terrorists tend to put down roots. So one thing is we have it's odd to think about it, but we have a stake in the ability of countries around the world essentially being viable. So it may mean aid, it may be military training, police training, intelligence support. It may mean giving their goods access into the United States. But in a global, interconnected world, what happens in some of these places has tremendous consequences, not just for them, but for us.
We've got several questions responding, I think, to a paper that you wrote in commentary about immigration and policy on immigration. There are at least four different questions related to that, including why won't government officials ease immigration for college grads and a series? Yeah. And perhaps the audience who hasn't read the commentary article would be interested in learning sure. your opinion.
Well, I actually find the American debate about immigration much too narrow. The entire debate is focused upon essentially illegal immigration, which is I understand why it's a legitimate concern, security, and otherwise. I'm also very interested, though, in legal immigration. I do not understand for the life of me why the United States has reduced by roughly 50% H-1B visas, which are the visas we provide for the most talented, trained people who want to come and stay in the United States. We've reduced them by roughly half since 9/11. This, if you look at the American economy, look at how many of the great companies we have that were started by immigrants. Why would we? So people come here, they come to our world-class universities, we give them a world-class education, then we kick them out. You explain to me the logic of this at a time we have 16% real unemployment. I just do not understand why legal immigration is not more of an issue, particularly given this jobs climate. So one thing I would do, if you can't get comprehensive immigration reform, and I can imagine comprehensive immigration reform which would deal with the illegal question, which would deal with the situation facing the 12 million or so individuals who are here who lack proper documentation, and would deal with the legal side. If you can't deal with all that, then I would separate out the legal side and move on that. I would just think that's one of the things we could do to help our economy right now.
A series of people are asking essentially the – can you get your glass?
Okay.
The what would you do question, and here's the way one of our audience phrased it. If you were the president and you had a congressional majority, what are the first three things you would do to address the problems you've highlighted?
By the time I answer that question, you will know why I'm not the president. look, I think the first thing is, again, some version of the to deal with the deficit. And I disagree with people in both parties, so I will annoy in an equal opportunity fashion. Willie Sutton was once asked why he robbed banks, and he said that's because that's where the money is. If you want to do something serious about the deficit, you've got to attack entitlements, and particularly on the health care side. That is the area of largest size and fastest growth. So unless you're going to deal with much more than Social Security, that's part of it, is Medicare, to a lesser extent Medicaid. You've got to deal with that. So I that would be part of it. The formula Roger Altman, former deputy secretary of the Treasury, and I came out with in a piece we wrote about a couple of years ago was a 3-to-1 ratio of spending cuts to revenue increases. I would stick with something like that. On the revenue side, I would go for tax simplification. I'd get rid of a lot of the so-called taxation expenditures and the various deductions for this or that. I would try to get income tax rates down because I want to increase consumer demand. I would probably look at potentially raising some other rates to compensate. So one area is to I would focus on is clearly the basic budget deal that and some aspects I thought of the Simpson-Bowles Commission were just fine. I thought it was a shame that the White House did not back it. I think it was a shame it was not enacted. I'm not as excited about this super committee process, but it's not going anywhere. But that would be the first thing I would focus on. Secondly, I do a lot on energy. I think the fact that the United States is still using as much oil as it uses four decades after the first oil shocks is nothing short of a national failure. I'd put a lot more emphasis on nuclear, a lot more on natural gas, a lot more on various types of regulation to discourage certain types of use. What else would I do? In no particular order, I would also, I'd say two other things. I've got to have four things. One is I would dial down more quickly the American involvement in Afghanistan. It is simply not worth $2 billion a week. It is not worth the number of the lives of extraordinary young men and women. I don't believe at the end of the day we will have results that will be commensurate with this investment. So I would much more rapidly reduce what it is we are doing in Afghanistan. And I feel like Rick Perry, and I was going to say something else, but now I can't remember. And it was a really good point. another reason why I'm not running for president.
The good news is we're very accommodating. If you think of the point later, you're welcome to weave it back in.
I got it. Okay.
It worked.
It's not eliminate the EPA either. The other thing is, and so much of the debate about our economy has been over stimulus programs and the rest, and I really think that's the wrong debate. You've got American companies sitting on roughly close to $2 trillion. So the real question I would ask is, how do we get American corporations to start spending, i.e. investing this money? And I think the answer there is we've got to create an environment in which they want to do it. So to think about government less as the engine of direct spending, jobs and all that, which I think is so much of the stimulus debate, which doesn't do it for me, and instead to think about government as the center of the context to the table. What is it the government means to do with regulatory policy, with tax policy, with immigration policy, with what have you, with the budget deficit, in order to give business the confidence that it can safely start making these long-term investments? And that's what we should be focusing on, much more than whether there's a second or third stimulus package or anything like that. That's old think. New think ought to be, how do we basically create an environment in which the real engines of American economic success essentially get going?
Well, we certainly suspect that you've demonstrated some of the skills for office, so I'm going to give you some other questions our colleagues have been asking. I'm going to give this as a choice, since you can. It's entirely political set of questions, and the choices range from, do you want to talk about which of the current candidates running for president have the stronger economic foreign relations backgrounds and therefore be a good president, or more locally, several questions are asking thoughts on Senator Lugar, who, as you know, is being challenged in a primary, and the role of people being challenged on the issues related to economics when their strengths are, as you know, in foreign affairs. Either question is up to you.
Is there an option C here?
Yes, I can give you.
I'm somewhat constrained because I'm fortunate enough to head a nonpartisan organization, so there's certain things I'm not allowed to do in the public space. I would just say, and also I've got Dick Lugar's a dear friend of mine for literally more than 3 decades. So it's
So should I give you the question about Latin America?
So let's move to Latin America. I would just say one thing, which is that the standard that candidates ought to be held to is. And I would say that so far it hasn't worked, is the scale of the, if I'm right in what I said in my remarks today, the nature and scale of the challenges this country faces are extraordinary. And they really ought to worry you. If you're willing to come out here on this rainy, miserable, maybe for you it's a nice day, I don't know, here in Indianapolis, everything's relative. But if you're willing, you obviously care about public policy issues tremendously. In order to, as good as the lunch was, you must care about these issues to be here. And so the question I have is, do we feel that the candidates and whether or the incumbents in general are being held to a sufficiently high standard that we get a sense of whether they are, who would be best or whether they are up to the challenge of dealing with the challenges and the problems this country faces? And I would simply say that ought to be the seriousness we look at everybody. This is really one of the critical times in this country's history. And I'm not always, shall we say, filled with the degree of confidence and assurance I'd like to be filled with.
Thank you.
Diplomatic enough?
That was diplomatic, I think, even for the IRS, which is the issue with nonprofit status. Question about South America. One of our colleagues here asked, what role will South America play in the future, especially Brazil, which is a topic that you didn't mention,
yeah.
Actually.
Well, one of this, Latin America is one of the great success stories. If we'd been having this lunch 20 or so years ago, and we had looked at the world, and we would have talked about all the problems in Latin America, it has evolved incredibly well. In some ways, only Europe is more democratic and open and peaceful. And Latin America is a close second. Yeah, there's a couple of outliers, but even Cuba is beginning to evolve, and I think Venezuela political change will come to. So Latin America is extraordinarily successful. It's largely democratic. It's largely market-oriented. It's almost entirely at peace. Not bad. Economically, it's been quite successful. Brazil's been an amazing success story. It's 200 million people. It's been growing north of 5%. So all in all, not bad. I think for the United States, it's not just a tremendous economic area of importance, and which we haven't exploited, by the way. We've really paid a price for our lack of a robust trade policy globally and regionally. It's one of, again, I do not understand it at a time when jobs are as precious as they are, why the United States has done so little to use the trade instrument of job creation. We've really hobbled. I do understand why, but it's unfortunate that the politics have gotten in front. Latin America, but imagine how different things would look in the world if Latin America were unstable. You know, we'd be having very different debates about whether the United States should be running around Afghanistan or Iraq or the former Yugoslavia as we did years ago if we really had to worry about things south. Our ability to do a lot of what we want to at home, and even more, our ability to do a lot of what we want to in the world, is premised on an unknowing assumption that things essentially in our neighborhood are stable. And if things in our neighborhood were to cease to be stable, we would have real problems. Mexico is the one area I'm obviously alluding to, and there's parts of particularly northern Mexico where the judicial and police and the security situations are being somewhat overwhelmed. And I think that's a function of what's going on in Mexico. It's obviously drug and criminal cartels, but it's also a function of America's appetite for drugs and the availability of guns in this country. And I would just simply say this is a real challenge facing us and facing Mexico, because ultimately Mexico's success will have more than a little impact on our own.
Let's give him a round of applause. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for taking the time today and challenging us. Thank you as an audience for generating certainly the most questions I've seen up here. And I think that's a testament to the topic and the way in which you presented it. Thank you. Also, thanks to our presentation sponsor, the IUPUI School of Liberal Arts, and our colleague Bill Bloomquist and his colleagues here today, as well as our luncheon sponsor, Herf Jones. And Joe, thank you for being here as well.
You've been listening to Dr. Richard Haass, President of the Council on Foreign Relations, part of the 2011-2012 Economic Club of Indiana series. Next month, our scheduled speaker is syndicated columnist DeRoy Murdoch, a senior fellow with the Atlas Economic Research Foundation. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of WFYI Radio in Indianapolis for Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. Thank you for joining us. I'm Sharon Allseth.
Proliance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. Proliance, adding power to energy. Information is at proliance.com.